The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WEFT-FM, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And now here is this week's edition of IMC Radio News.
Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
This week on IMC Radio News, we'll have an interview with Joe Salatin, a family farmer and permaculture practitioner who will be speaking in Illinois in July. But first, this headline from Peter Miller on the Communication Workers of America strike.
Fighting to prevent their jobs from moving overseas and to protect health care for themselves and retirees, 100,000 workers for SBC Corporation launched a four-day strike last Friday. The employees have union representation with the Communications Workers of America. Picket lines went up in 13 states across the country, where the telecom giant was struck by everyone from directory assistance workers to the women and men who install and repair phone lines. Speaking on the Illinois Labor Hour last Saturday, Joanna Guerra, the president of CWA Local 4215 in Danville, explained what was at stake for the employees.
We need to keep our jobs in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have been the workers and the customers that have built these companies in the United States.
SBC includes three main businesses: its land-based phone service, its cell phone service, and high-speed internet connections. The land-based phones and the cell phone services are both union, while the internet service is largely non-union, and SBC chose to outsource service representatives to people in developing countries, a move that insulted current employees.
And it's disheartening to the union, because we have been so supportive with this company in getting their long-distance launch, DSL, getting win-backs of customers that have went to other companies.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you know, 29,000 workers that have been laid off mm-hmm. in the last 3 years. That then for them to contract this work out to, you know, another country, when we have union members in this country that could do that job, it's like really a slap in the face to us.
The jobs of the strikers are protected under the current contract, as Heather Cunningham, the union's vice president, described.
Article 26 in our contract now is a contract provision saying that the hometown job and the extended hometown job area, mm-hmm. if they would surplus any of the employees out, they would be offered a hometown job.
Very
SBC
important.
Wants to take that article basically out of the contract and say if they would offer us a job anywhere in the United States and we didn't take it, then that's considering that we quit our job.
Quitting to avoid relocating would mean that an employee would lose all company benefits as well as unemployment benefits. Union leaders also contend that SBC is attempting to transfer health care costs onto employees. They say that SBC initially tried to increase premiums paid to company retirees.
They were going to try and shift premiums for the retirees. They're on a fixed income the way it is, and what the company was proposing for premiums for the retirees was not acceptable, not by any means.
After the union refused to sell out the retirees, they say the company tried to increase premiums in other areas, move which the union found hard to accept given the company's $8 billion in profits reported by Forbes magazine and given the $20 million bonus paid to company CEO Edward Whitaker. Union workers also say they sacrificed raises in the past to maintain strong health care benefits. SBC's corporate websites contains press statements saying that they regret the strike and that they conducted a poll of SBC customers and claim that 90% of respondents support SBC's contract proposals. SBC also says that its services are working well despite the strike, with managers staffing the company. However, commercial news reports suggest that customer service is being hurt. As the struggle for health care, job security, and a fair contract continue, the CWA is asking their supporters to sign a pledge to switch their service to AT&T, another union phone company, if a fair settlement isn't reached. The strike continues through Monday night. This is Peter Miller reporting from Urbana, Illinois.
Thanks to Peter Miller for that report. You can find out more about the CWA at www.cwa-union.org. Last week, I conducted an interview with Joel Salatin, a third-generation alternative farmer in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. He will be speaking on July 27th in Kempton, Illinois, at a 14-day permaculture designer's course, and I spoke to him about some of the themes he will cover in his section of that course. Maybe you could start off with just giving me a background of yourself.
Sure. We came to this farm when I was four, and mom and dad, you know, started farming here in this location in 1961. And dad was very much a visionary. In fact, his father before him was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine when it first came out there right after World War II. Mm-hmm. And so dad got his kind of conservation, non-chemical, natural bent from his dad, and then I got it from my dad. And we came here to Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, which you may know is the breadbasket of the Confederacy during the Civil War. And it's an interesting climatological area because it's in the same horticultural zone as South Dakota. A lot of people think you go south, yeah, and everybody just, you know, wears tank tops and sandals. But that's not the case here. We get a couple feet of snow every winter, and we bury water lines 3 feet deep to keep them from freezing. Our frost dates are May 15, September 15. And this was tall grass when it was originally settled. And of course, it was settled by people who came from a temperate climate in Europe. And they came in and took this fairly harsh climate, you know, thunderstorms and freezing and thawing and a much more arid situation, and plowed it and planted annuals. And so when we came in 1961, this farm, you know, as so many of them do, sported 10 to 16 foot deep gullies. Rocks were growing out of the ground. Of course, we know they don't grow out. The soil leaves from around them. And this area was essentially rape farmed for a couple of centuries before we came in 61. And so we planted and let grow back about 60 acres of trees for conservation reasons on steep hillsides and that sort of thing, and began from a large scale trying to intersect riparian, forestal, and open areas. Those three great environments, open land, forest land, and water, kind of got things stabilized by the late 60s, and we were building soil and began trying to see how we could make a living from the farm. And being non-chemical, we went to grass-based, forage-based everything. And today we raise salad bar beef, figurator pork, pastured poultry, forage-based rabbits and turkeys and eggs, lumber, and anything else we can make a dime at ecologically and emotionally satisfactorily. Keep shoes on.
You'll have to explain figurator pork, because I'm quite certain we haven't heard of that one around here.
Sure. Figurator pork. This name came to me because when we started with pigs, we didn't actually, as so many things we do, we weren't just actually raising something to raise pork. We were trying to use the animals to fill an important use niche on the farm. And we were doing large-scale composting, you know, making these long windrows that you see.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to try out pigs instead so that we wouldn't have to use petroleum or machinery to do the aerobic composting. So what we do is we allow the cows to eat hay in the winter. We don't carry the hay to the cows. We bring the cows to the hay, which is in a large open shed. And it's roofed, of course, and we use carbon sources, wood chips, sawdust, old hay, straw. You can use any carbonaceous source. In your part of the country, it could be soybean hulls and corn cobs, mm-hmm, ground up, but for a carbon base, for bedding, and that carbon locks up the highly volatile nutrients that are coming out of the back of the cow at 50 pounds per head per day, and provides a tremendous chemically stable nutrient sink. And this bedding pack then just builds up through the winter, and it's anaerobic. So we add whole-shelled corn to it, and it ferments in that anaerobic medium. Then when the cows come out in the spring, we turn the pigs in, and the pigs then seek that fermented corn and essentially go through like a huge rotavator, egg beater, through that bedding pack, rip it all up, inject oxygen, hence the aeration, pig aerator, okay, and churn it all up and turn it so that the entire hay-feeding facility that housed the cows in the winter becomes the composting fertilizer factory piggery in the spring. And the pigs do all the work. They don't need the oil change. They don't need minimum wage. They never sue you for giving them a bad job. And it's truly hog heaven. It allows the pigs to fully express their pigness by using the plow on the end of their nose. And we think that that's important for our food system, is to allow every element of the food system to thrive in a habitat that allows it to fully express its physiological distinctiveness.
Interesting. Well, one of the aspects of your talk is that you concentrate a lot on the relationships that go into building a family business that will actually be sustainable and allow you to make a living and won't cause you to go bankrupt in 5 years. So could you talk a little bit just about your approach to building a farm that actually, you know, supports the farm?
Sure. Well, one of the first ingredients is we have to make a profit, and profit isn't everything, but it is something. And so we have to make a profit. We have to make enough profit that allows all of the stakeholders to be properly compensated, and to be compensated in a way that will make it emotionally satisfying. And so one of the ways to do that is to let animals do the work, so that we take out the things, the infrastructure that rots, rusts, and depreciates. So, for example, instead of putting the cows through the head gate to give them Ivomec that makes the meat so bad it kills all the bugs, we run an eggmobile behind the cows to let the chickens scratch through the cow patties, turn the fly larvae and grasshoppers and crickets into a cash crop, eggs. And what this does is that it layers, and this is, of course, a perfect permaculture concept of layering a symbiotic enterprise on an existing core enterprise. For example, if you're running a dairy, for example, the conventional dairy in the U.S., every cow produces enough bypass grain, undigested grain, through her manure to produce $100 worth of eggs a year. So that any 100-cow dairy, you could layer a $10,000 a year egg operation on it, and that's all clear profit. Now, I'm not suggesting we feed dairy cows grain. Mm-hmm. All I'm suggesting is that by layering symbiotic circles into the production, we can cut costs and ratchet up income, which allows us to create enough income to compensate in an emotionally satisfying way the stakeholders in the outfit. We believe that's the beginning of sustainability. The average farmer doesn't even want their children go into farming. Because, A, you know, they say you can't make any money farming. That's number one. And they want their kids to have a better life than they did. And number two is, you know, it's dirty and it's disease and it's dusty and it stinks. And we've created a culture today that demeans as a bunch of ignoramus, redneck, tobacco-spitting, trip-over-the-transmission in the front yard person is the caretaker of our landscape, our food system. And so we farmers must hold our head high and honor our own vocation with thought-provoking design and symbiotic systems that allow us to get properly compensated for our work.
So where do you come up with the ideas for these types of systems? Is it just based on observation of what's already happening? Are you reading up on it? Are you following other people's leads? You know, is it a combination of all of that? Or
It's E, all of the above. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, very few ideas we've had are really original. It's just adaptations of the old. You know, the neat thing is that now, by marrying Western techno-glitzy stuff with heritage desires of plants and animals, we can actually produce more ecologically sound, emotionally sound, and economically sound today than you could 100 years ago. One of the best examples I know is poultry net fencing. This is brand new technology in the last couple of decades, but it's a you know, it's a polyethylene woven fence with stainless steel threads running through it to carry a spark that 150 feet of it weighs 12 pounds and can be put up and taken down by one person in 10 minutes. But it keeps out bears, coyotes, dogs, and keeps chickens and turkeys in. 50 years ago, if you wanted a fence that would keep out possums, dogs, coyotes, bears, and keep in chickens and turkeys, the fence would weigh 100 pounds a foot.
Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be easy to put it up and take it down when you needed to move your pasture.
And it certainly wouldn't be portable. Right. That's right. I call it the ultimate information-based agriculture. It's outsourced, downsized, restructured, miniaturized. I mean, the beauty of that is it allows us now to raise, on a commercial scale, large groups of domestic fowl protected from predation and move them very easily around a pasture situation in large numbers so that it actually is more chicken-friendly, more environmentally friendly, and higher nutritionally than the backyard flock on an American cabin 150 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's incredible. It's wonderful.
I think that's encouraging to hear, because I think that one of the perception problems or the marketing problems permaculture has when we're talking to traditional farmers around here is that they see it as anti-technology or as Luddite or as, you know,
yes,
losing, not willing to take advantage of things that have come along in the past 100 years. So
absolutely. Yes, that's one of the first things I tell people when they come to our farm is, look, I don't want you leaving here saying, oh, that's the way Grandpa did it. we want to take the best of what Grandpa did, and that was a diversified farm, not a monospeciated farm, but mm-hmm. a diversified farm with a lot of variation in the flora and fauna, and we want to take the best of that, but we want to also marry it to the very best of the modern technology that allows us to enhance, you know, not override, not arrogantly destroy and override the natural wisdom like genetic engineering or irradiation or factory farms or vaccines or, you know, chemicals like those do, but rather take nature's template and lay it down on our domestic operations. Use our technology to enhance the natural patterns, the natural templates that we see in nature, just like we do with the eggmobile with the cows. You know, we look at nature and say, how does nature sanitize behind herbivores? You know, how did these herbivores stay alive before Merck Pharmaceuticals and Pfizer and all these companies, Eli Lilly, how did they stay alive? Well, they stayed alive with the symbiosis of birds, you know, the egret on the rhino's nose, the symbiosis of the birds as sanitizers following the undulating herds of herbivores. We follow the cows with the chickens, and we simply mimic domestically what we see as a natural template. And suddenly what you have is a healthy cow herd, and you have thousands of dollars worth of eggs as a byproduct of the pasture sanitation program, and you suddenly have doubled the income per acre, so you've created enough income per acre to either hire yourself full-time or hire a partner, a young partner, that comes alongside and makes an income, you know, in conjunction with the dairy or the beef or the orchard or whatever else, whatever mm-hmm. the mothership was. And that's one of the things we desperately need today in our agriculture, with the median age of the American farmer now right at about 60. But one of the desperate needs of our time is to ratchet up our income per acre so that we create additional revenue streams from the existing land, building, and machinery base, mm-hmm. 80% of which is owned by and controlled by people who have already done their life's most productive and creative work.
And then you're actually improving the land as you do it, so you're not capitalizing at the expense of the land. You're actually you're leaving
Good
the
point.
Land in better shape than where you found it. So
yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what kinds of, if someone were to attend your talk in Kempton, what would be the types of things, techniques? Is it going to be just a broad overview, or are you really going to be getting down to the nuts and bolts of livestock on that type of a farm?
We're going to definitely do nuts and bolts. We're going to be doing techniques and aspects, you know, very, very how-to aspects of controlled grazing, fencing, water systems, you know, the differences between the different species, because obviously the kind of fencing and kind of animal movement patterns, techniques, rests, and grazing patterns are different between a chicken and a cow and a pig and all that. So, you know, we're going to be going into the nuances of that, how to integrate them, and we're even going to be doing some marketing, session on marketing, direct marketing. How do we access the retail dollar with this livestock produced food, and how do we, you know, how do we get this income up into the $2,000 to $3,000 an acre realm instead of, you know, 50 to 100? So yeah, it's going to be very, very practical. We're going to start broad overview landscape. How do we you know, look at water, forest, and pasture, and we're going to narrow down very, very quickly to actual design concepts, housing concepts, infrastructure, composting, nutrient cycling, all that nitty gritty.
Excellent. With respect to just connecting to local market, do you target farmers markets? Are you going door to door? What are the types of clients for your farm?
We have four legs on our marketing stool. The first leg in our core is still the farm gate sale, what we call the on-farm sale. Mm-hmm. And we supply about 300 to 350 families who actually come to the farm and buy their food. And then the next component, which is about the same size, a percentage of sales, is restaurants. And we use a subcontractor to do the weekly deliveries, but we supply about 35 restaurants with high quality food, meat products, poultry and eggs. Then the next leg of the stool is a fellow who takes our stuff to metropolitan farmers markets, kind of a middleman, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And he buys things pretty much at farm gate price, but then increases the value by going into the metropolitan area where he can get his 30% markup and still outcompete the organic supermarket. And it's a very, you know, very close link. And the fourth leg are about six metropolitan buying clubs that we have that are, you know, just a group of people, group of families get together. We service them bi-monthly. All the orders are handled either, you know, through email or faxes or phone. Electronically, we put the orders together and take it up, and so they have like a, you know, 30-minute window to meet us. And it allows them to get it directly from the farmer. The volume pays for our transportation. They pay a, you know, a delivery fee. And it's a wonderful way to, for people in the city to directly access, you know, the top quality stuff that we produce. So those are our four marketing legs, and we like having multiple strands of marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Too.
And this is all on how many acres?
We have 100 acres open and 450 in woodland. We're essentially supporting four white-collar salaries on the farm, and we believe we could probably support 20 or 25. It just take time. We're going to be in corn and bean country.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I realize the price of beans has gone way up lately, just like the price of beef cattle and corn is way up too. But anybody that's been in a long time knows that these prices, they won't stay there. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, the global economy is having a tremendous effect on the commodity business. I think it's important just to point out that, you know, with the offshore production creating the floor price for commodities, that any farmer needs to think, especially farmers that are medium size, not the huge farmers, because they do compete with the world on scale, and I understand that. But for medium and down farmers, they're getting squeezed harder and harder because they don't have the economies of scale to pay for the capital, you know, the tractor and the combine. Mm-hmm. And all the things to do it. I mean, I'm not even discussing ecology right here for a minute. I'm just talking about pure economics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the point being that small to medium farmers, the cost squeeze is making them obsolete. The cost price squeeze, and they're also, that's why they're the ones going out of business. And so I think that our model and our paradigm offers a real solution to people that are looking to reduce their equipment, reduce their input costs and increase their sale price by having the retail dollar and the stability of being able to be a price maker instead of a price taker. When we set our prices, our customers are paying our price. You know, we don't grow it and then go down and present it as a sacrificial lamb before the grain elevator or the sale barn, take whatever we get. Set our price, and our customers can either pay it or go elsewhere. What this does is it allows us to short-circuit, opt out, make an end run, however you want to say it, but it allows us to extricate ourselves from that commodity treadmill that forces you to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Are there schemes for people that are already on that treadmill, the corn and bean farmers that are looking at either farm this way or give it up? Are there transitional models where they can take, you know, 5-10 acres and start working this in, or do they have to go whole hog?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the beauties of this type of agriculture that's, well, I call it information-based as opposed to depreciation-based. And that is that most of our prototypes, most of the models that I've been discussing are extremely size neutral, in that you don't finally make your profit on the millionth pound or the millionth gallon or the millionth bushel. Take, for example, the piggerators to do the composting, okay? The corn trades off the machinery costs to have made the compost. Mm-hmm. So the pigs are basically free. When you can let the animals do the work that don't need their transmissions replaced, oil changed, and don't need spare parts, you don't have to generate the volume to recapitalize the infrastructure that rots, rusts, and depreciates. And as a result, your profit margin can go through the roof because your production does not wear out things. You're using appreciating, you're using tractors that you bought for $50 and you sell for $30. That's pretty decent equipment depreciation.
It certainly is.
Everybody'd like a tractor like that. I haven't found any green pigs yet.
And the pigs don't have air-conditioned cabs either. But.
No, but I'll tell you what, they sure are much more fun to watch work than spend all day being a John Deere jockey breathing in diesel fumes. And, you know, I think that's an important point that a lot of people miss, is I've kind of come to the conclusion that to be this kind of farmer, you kind of have to be a sissy. It's just not very masculine to come in and say, well, I made the cows happy today, or I made the pigs happy today. It's a lot more manly to come in and say, you know, well, I ripped up the back 40 and burned the transmission out of the tractor, and, you know, smell me. Don't I smell like grease? And there's something, you know, really manly about that. And what we do is we observe, you know, what makes the pig happy, what makes the chicken happy, and then try to make that animal as happy as possible. And amazingly, when we make that animal as happy as possible to fully express its physiological distinctiveness, guess what? You know, we don't have vet bills. We don't have to know anything about diseases. The nutrition of the animal goes up. Our customers are healthy. They're happy. Sales go up. Taste is better. Texture is better. Keepability is better. You know, eggs make pastries last twice as long because of their moist, retentive qualities. I mean, all these neat things begin happening when you start doing that nurturing aspect of caretaking as opposed to industrial exploitation. What can I get the fastest, the cheapest, quickest today?
If you'd like to find out more about the conference in Kempton, you can visit stellcommunity.com. That's STELLE community.com. To learn more about permaculture in general, you can visit, among other places, permaculture.com. And to get connected to local folks doing permaculture right here in Urbana-Champaign and the surrounding countryside, you can visit the website of the Urbana Permaculture Project, www.prairienet.org/UPP. That wraps up IMC Radio News for this week. Contributors included Peter Miller and myself, Clint Popetz. If you'd like to get involved, please stop by our weekly meeting Tuesdays at noon at the IMC, 218 West Main Street in downtown Urbana, or drop us a line at radio@ucimc.org. Archives of this show are available on the web, www.ucimc.org. Take care, and thanks for listening.